Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, happy Friday. Welcome back to The Realignment's daily coverage of the crisis in Ukraine following Russia's invasion of the country. Today's topic for the zoom in, zoom out focus is Europe. I've got an excellent guest, Bill Drozdniak. He's joining us from Brussels, where he's currently traveling, to discuss his most recent book, The Last President of Europe, Emmanuel Macron's Race to Revive France and Save the World. We also speak about his previous book from 2017, Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West. We are taking a look at Europe and how the invasion of Ukraine has or hasn't papered over the issues that faced the country after 2015, from the Syrian refugee crisis to Brexit to a longer-term debate about Europe's defense posture, how it structures its economies and its welfare states, and its relationship to the United States. This is a great follow-up to our discussion with Bridge Colby on Monday, which really focused on how the U.S. should focus on pivoting away from Europe in the face of the rise of China. Quick note, we spent a lot of time discussing Emmanuel Macron specifically and how his centrist, almost populist campaign and style has been deeply important, and how that does or does not affect how U.S. leaders should think about reforming our own political system. So lots of great stuff here. A lot of folks are going to have seen Macron when we were looking at his initial negotiations with Putin before the invasion, and that picture of him in a sweatshirt slash hoodie, which seemed to be aping the way Zelensky goes about in his days. So lots of great stuff. You're going to enjoy this one. Quick thing before we go into the show, this is a great time to shout out once again the Substack. It's going out on Friday today. Normally these go out on Thursdays, but today we're going to put it out on Friday because we're summing up the 5 episodes we've put out this week. So be sure to follow the show notes and subscribe there if you have not already. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here's the episode. Bill Drozdniak, welcome to The Realignment.
My pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for coming on the show. Today's topic is Europe before and after Russia's invasion. You wrote a book in 2017 called Fractured Continent. It was talking about all of the challenges facing Europe, specifically leaders such as Theresa May of Great Britain, Angela Merkel of Germany, immigration, refugees, Brexit, etc. Looking at the past month, though, is it too much of an overstatement to argue that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has essentially glued the continent back together, or am I missing something?
No, there's no question that this crisis, war in Ukraine conducted by Russia, has galvanized the entire continent against Russia's brutal aggression. Now, how long it will last, I just don't know. I mean, there is an attempt to try and work together with the United States in putting an end as quickly as possible to this war. But those divisions, the fractures within Europe that I talked about between North and South, East and West, still linger beneath the surface. And if and when we ever resolve this crisis, which I think is going to take some time, and I think it will require a whole new security order to be constructed. So there will be other priorities. But nonetheless, I think the fractures, the tensions that we saw beneath the surface will continue and could reemerge in the future. I mean, one example is we don't know what the effect of millions of Ukrainians coming into Poland and other countries will have politically, just as we saw the influx of Syrian immigrants created a political crisis, in the sense that the far right, xenophobic right wing parties in several countries, Italy, France, Belgium, Germany, took off, really ignited because of voter disgruntlement with all these refugees coming in. Now, I think there was a clear note of racism, in the sense that these were Muslims from Syria, the Middle East. Here we have white ethnic Europeans coming in from Ukraine. And in fact, many Poles over the centuries have have been integrated with Ukraine. So there's a quite a historical connection there. But nonetheless, there will be more and more arguments, I think, politically, that will say, well, these immigrants are stealing jobs and hurting our income and causing a drain on our treasuries. But that's way down the road. Right now, we're still 1 month into this war, and there's a great surge of unity to repel this aggression.
I want to speak to how discreet of an event we should treat the invasion, because to your point, there's this question of how long can this invasion serve to almost paper over or push aside the underlying tensions? And my question would be, is this a discrete event that, let's say, can be resolved, let's say by June, just to pick a random date? Or is this a longer term shift in mentality that will that could permanently paper over, in the sense that in the Cold War, you had the Berlin crisis, you had all sorts of events happen. But even when those crises were resolved, the broader thing that mattered was the fact that there was a Cold War between the East and the West. So how should we think of this within that context?
I think, well, one of the most important facts to bear in mind is the historical origins of this crisis. And in particular, it shows how history comes around time and time again. It doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. A lot of people overlook the fact that World War II, the origin of Hitler's invasions, his main obsession was to gain control over Ukraine, which was then known as the breadbasket of Eastern Europe. He wanted to destroy the Soviet Union. The occupation of France, Western Europe, the bombing of Britain were sort of a sideshow for him. But his obsession, and he's talked about this, and other historians like Tim Snyder at Yale emphasize this, that that Ukraine was really at the origin of World War II. And now we see Ukraine once again, the sort of the in the cockpit of this crisis. And so we'll. It's hard to see how far, how this will progress. I mean, because we could see a whole new dimension to this conflict. If Putin's troops, who have performed with remarkably bad performance on the ground, if they get in further trouble because of the strong and fierce resistance from Ukrainian fighters, who will become better and better armed as more anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons reach them from the West, that he could feel cornered and desperate and might resort to chemical, biological weapons, as President Biden warned today here in Brussels at the NATO summit, or even using theater nuclear weapons. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said the other day that he wouldn't rule it out. So that's why Ukraine is so important historically, but also we're on the cusp of a potential kind of conflict that could bring nuclear or biological and chemical weapons into the European theater.
I'm glad you've brought up the historical World War II, even pre-World War II context for Ukraine. To stick with that history, one can easily, and once again, this isn't my thought, this is just basic historical work, but a central question in the late 19th and then 20th century that wasn't resolved until 1989 was Germany's place in Europe. What is Germany? How does it relate to France? How does it relate to the rest of the continent? How does it prove itself an economic powerhouse while also not being militarily aggressive? It seems like a central question in the 21st century for Europe then, given the history you're discussing, is what is Ukraine's role in relationship to Europe? So to your point earlier around whether or not the refugees would be an issue, how would you just place Ukraine within 21st century Europe?
Well, you know, you make a very good point. I mean, for decades after World War II, everybody was obsessed with the German question. how can we find a way to channel Germany onto a peaceful path? And I think we did so with great success. When you look at the prosperity and the strong democracy that the Federal Republic of Germany has achieved over the last 75 years. Now, I think, and for the foreseeable future, which could be decades, the big question is, what do we do about Russia, and in particular, the neighboring countries that have been traditionally exploited and used by Russia because of its fear of invasion as a buffer zone? And how will we find a way of threading the needle and ensuring the security of the Ukrainian people in the future, and for that matter, Moldova, Georgia, and some of the other neighboring countries, not to mention Poland and the Baltic states within NATO already. But also, how can we channel Russia's grievances against the West toward getting resolved in a way that we can bring them into the security order? And in my latest book, The Last President of Europe, I found in my conversations with Emmanuel Macron, this was a question that was already troubling him when he first entered office 5 years ago. And that's why he invited, as his first state visitor, as the president of France, he invited Vladimir Putin to France. Didn't invite the American president, then Trump, or the German prime minister, who was Angela Merkel at the time. He invited Putin because he thought, and he, as he explained to me, Europe will only achieve lasting peace and security when it can establish a strategic understanding with Russia. And his approach was to appeal to Putin that Russia's destiny lies with the West. So he said, he told me, he says, I'm convinced he will believe it because he's a son of St. Petersburg. And of course, Russia through the centuries has had this tug of war between the East and then the reformers who wanted to become part of the West. And it, Macron told me specifically, I end practically every conversation with Putin by invoking the names of Peter the Great, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Pushkin, as a way to remind him of his background as a son of St. Petersburg, and that Russia can only achieve the full potential of its sounds by aligning with the West. Now, Macron's approach was, we need to keep Russia from falling into the arms of China. And he said, from a European perspective, this would, an alliance between Russia and China would isolate Europe on the western edge of the Eurasian landmass at a time when its traditional ally and partner, the United States, is shifting its attention and its resources to dealing with the confrontation with China in the Indo-Pacific. And this is... this has really gained momentum, I think, and Macron would be surprised at it, but he was the first one to raise this this morning, and his other the other European leaders simply did not respond to his insistence that Europe needed to start standing up in defense of its own interests on the world stage, which he called strategic autonomy, but a better description is European sovereignty. Vis-a-vis and standing up to the United States as well as China and Russia, so that it would not be picked apart in the resurgence of big power rivalry that we see today. And unfortunately, his warnings have proven very prescient. A big concern we all have, particularly in the United States now, is how deep is this partnership between China and Russia? Will China even cast its lot with Russia in the war against Ukraine? And will this lead to a breakup of the global economy?
We'll get to Macron in a second, because I think in many ways, his story is going to be deeply interesting to our listenership. But I want to circle back to what you said around the German question and then relate that to effectively what you are pointing out here, which is the Russian question. How do you integrate Russia into the economic, cultural, and security environment in a way that Germany was able to be answered? Because the depressing answer here is the way that the German question was resolved was tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of deaths, and then a 60-year quasi could go hot at any second Cold War that required a massive military occupation from two different directions. If you're looking at Russia, then something that I don't want to be too rude here, but oftentimes folks who are apologizing for Russia, what we'll argue is, look, there are all these instances where, for example, Putin would raise the prospect of joining NATO in 2000, that was batted away. There are all these examples, especially after 2003, where the US unilaterally went into Iraq, where Putin was very clearly convinced that the West is operating, especially the George W. Bush-led West, with Tony Blair, was operating in bad faith. So can you just assess this project of trying to invite Russia in? And what do you think was implemented in good faith? What was in bad faith? How should we understand this attempt to answer the question since the Cold War ended?
Yeah, well, there's, as you probably know, there's a continuing debate in the United States among scholars, think tank experts, politicians, and historians. Talking about the idea of did we make a mistake in the West about the enlargement of NATO and 30 years ago. And at the time, George Kennan, the premier Russia expert in the United States, warned it would be a strategic blunder of monumental proportions if we took in these new democracies in the East, because it would generate long-term grievances in Russia. And he turned out to be correct. Other scholars like John Niersheimer from the University of Chicago would say, we should have seen this coming. And this has been a case of where we were sleepwalking into this crisis, and that the West, and particularly the United States, by driving the enlargement of NATO and also the European Union, that we were not taking account of how we had betrayed promises. And they weren't written down, but they were, I think, understood that we would not take advantage of Russia's weakness at the time. And I think this is what is nurturing Putin's obsession with, he's talked about the breakup of the Soviet Union being the greatest geopolitical disaster in the previous century. And I think there are political reasons also because he didn't want to see a democratic and prospering Ukraine develop in such a way that it would threaten his regime in Russia and encourage the Russian people to protest. So all of this is now coming home to it's coming home to roost, and we're going to have to deal and find a way to think long and hard about the place of Russia in the European political culture. I mean, it's a huge country, 9 time zones, and we cannot afford to see it just picked off by the dictatorship in Beijing in such a way that Russia would be exploited in ways that it remains permanently anti-Western. So that will be a big challenge. It's pretty hard to see how we could ever achieve that even if Putin withdraws his troops, whether as long as he's in power, we would be able to do that, because we've already accused him of war crimes and we want to see him on trial in The Hague. But it's going to require a concerted long-term effort to try and bring Russia back into the civilized world. We started with Germany. I think this is one of the great achievements, is that here was this totalitarian, awful Nazi regime that in the aftermath, we succeeded in making peace with one of our most heinous adversaries. and similarly with Japan, and brought both Japan and Germany into the world of modern democracy. We failed to do that with Russia. There were people who said, why don't we even consider, back in the early 90s, why don't we even consider bringing Russia into NATO? And Putin, as you alluded to, raised that point as well as recently as 2002. And nobody, by that time, nobody really wanted to take it seriously. So when he made his infamous speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, it was a blistering diatribe against the West. And that really is the start of the destruction of Russia's relationship with the democratic West.
You know, the depressing thing about the story you told about Germany and Japan is, in those cases, it took the destruction of both societies. And a key difference here is the entire political leadership, even moving lower and lower and lower, was literally hung or shot at Nuremberg and the Japanese equivalent there. So there's this difficult point of, and I guess this is what the hope of the European projects post-Cold War, which was that the soft power aspects, the economic aspects, the identity-based aspects would be attractive in a way that would reform Russia internally without requiring the hard power of the Cold War. But something I want to get to is you repeatedly referred to we when it comes to accepting Russia into Europe. An interesting dynamic that is a huge difference between the 1990s and even the 2000s is the fact that not as much of this feels up to the United States in a way that it could have been previously. The Europeans are rearming. Let's just say the Poles are going to have a different answer to the question of whether Russia should be integrated into Europe after this crisis than maybe more realistic leadership in the US would have. So how should we think of the degree to which the Europeans have autonomy in a way that is almost certainly different than what occurred during the 2000s and 1990s?
Well, I think important role the United States has played in recent decades as, I would say, a European power was to referee these lingering tensions. You point out quite rightly that Poland has a very visceral dislike, even hatred, one would say, of Russia and fear that Russia would once again invade territorial Poland. That feeling is not so much shared in France or even in Germany. There are a lot of Russophiles in Germany, particularly within the Social Democrat Party, who feel a sense of historical guilt, and they think that it's a natural bridge for Germany, which needs oil and gas to establish an economic relationship with Russia, and Germany would sell its automobiles, and it would be a very comfortable and prosperous relationship. But history has a way of getting making things complicated. It's going to be a long time for Russia to really settle on a clear and fair and honest accounting of what led to this war in Ukraine. Germany has been struggling for decades after World War II about what was the real guilt. And you may recall the 1968 student protests erupted in Germany, mainly because that the young generation were asking their parents, well, what did you do in the war? Were you really closet Nazis or not? And there were families that were just torn apart over this within Germany, in Western Germany. And of course, East Germany dealt with this by saying, well, we were all communists. We were persecuted by the Nazis. So we had nothing to do with that. The Nazis are all in the West. Similarly, I think Russia is going to have an accounting of its own long history of tyranny, of dictators, because the period in the 90s, this brief flirtation with democracy, which didn't last very long, is very much against the the standards of Russian history, going way back into the 18th and 19th century. So what will it be to, it's going to take perhaps some new kind of leader who can really galvanize the people there and lead them toward some kind of new promised land. But even those who are some of the most admirable politicians, like Alexei Navalny, who has been bravely pointing out the kleptocracy and the corruption surrounding Putin. Well, even he is has a strange nationalistic approach. For example, he was applauding the annexation of Crimea, and also believes that much of Ukraine belongs to Russia. So that's not something that's going to sit well with the Ukrainians if by chance he should ever be freed from jail and become sort of the welcomed as the new political hero. So it's hard to tell how this is going to play out, but it's going to require a whole new generation. It's going to require a new set historians who will agree on a new arrangement of facts so that Russia can enter the 21st century.
I want to speak to Macron and your book on him. So can you just introduce him, introduce his story? He's an interesting figure because something you hear, especially amongst younger listeners, is dissatisfaction with the political leadership class in the United States. It's too old. It's too rooted in outmoded ideologies. And in many ways, Macron, he's incredibly young when it comes to being ahead of state. He, in terms of his political program, is neither left nor right in the conventional sense. So there are parts of him that I just find very attractive. Could you just speak to him, speak to his project, speak of where he started and how things ended up, and then why you referred to him as the last president of Europe?
Right. Well, that really was the motivation for my project to write the book. When he was first elected, I thought, how is it possible that this 39-year-old who has a background in finance and but had never been elected to political office, no, not even at the local level, nothing, ascends to the French presidency. And I was curious to see how he would cope with the travails of power and how he would use the enormous tools of influence in the French president. Because the presidency of France is probably one of the most powerful political offices in any of our Western democracies. And to see Macron come in, as you point out, with a fresh philosophy, I'm neither right nor left. I want to apply what works. France needs to be shaken up. He titled his own political project a revolution. He wanted to make it a social, economic, and political revolution that would, initially it was quite appealing to younger generation, in particular his age, who were frustrated with the old guard, the traditional definitions of rivalries between the communist socialist left and the Gaullist conservatives on the right. And of course, inevitably, he ran into difficulties. He had a couple of important successes, such as staring down the train unions, which are very powerful in France. But domestically, he had a lot of difficulties. And I was able to strike up a rapport with him. We spoke in French, and so he was kind of intrigued by the fact that here's this American journalist writer who's covering him and could speak his native language, which was important. And while he speaks decent English, I thought it was important to hear his nuances and the nimble thinking that lies behind his political philosophy. And I guess about 2 years in, I asked him, what is it that has surprised you about being in politics now that you've been president for 2 years? And he kind of leaned back for about 10 seconds and he says, I think it's just the sheer hatred that I feel on the part of so many people who are engaged in politics. He says, it's one thing to disagree with your policy approach and all this. It's another thing to be stringing him up in effigy and calling him the son of a whore. And this was what he was subjected to when he was dealing with the Yellow Vest protesters. More remarkably, because I think as an American writer, I was more interested in his vision of the world and how he wanted to reform it, because he's 30 years younger than I am. I was intrigued by the fact that he's really the avatar of a new generation coming to power. We still haven't seen that in the United States, where we've got a president of 79 and leaders in Congress who are like Nancy Pelosi in her 80s, and kind of wonder when we're going to make the transition to 40-somethings or even 30-somethings who can start running and leading our society. But he was particularly interesting. I mentioned how he started out trying to seduce and cultivate Putin, his thoughts about China, where he has been making trips at least once a year, and of course how he dealt with Donald Trump. And he alone among European leaders at the outset had a very comfortable and easy relationship with Trump. And that's because I said, well, what is it in terms of personality? You're totally opposite. You're much more intellectual. Trump is a businessman. He goes, yes, but we have a lot in common. Neither of us have been elected before. And both of us are political mavericks who have different views about, don't believe in ideology. So he was hopeful that he could become the Trump whisperer, but that didn't really last. So, but at least, again, you got to give him marks for trying. And just as he's been trying to do trying to nurture a dialogue with Putin, because it's important that somebody on the outside makes Putin look at reality, because he's so isolated and getting such a distorted and twisted view of the war and the outside world that it's good that Macron is speaking to him on a regular basis. I might add, the last time I talked with Macron, which saw him last week in Paris, we're now exactly 1 month into this war. He has spoken at least 15 times with Putin on the phone, and most of the calls were instigated by Putin. So it's clear that he's looking for somebody to have a dialogue with, and that person has been Macron so far.
And you described Macron as the last president of Europe in the actual title of the book. So when we saw him traveling to Russia before the invasion, we see these 15 phone calls. Should we understand him, especially post Angela Merkel, post Brexit, as the president of Europe, quote unquote? Like, what is the European part of his project? You hinted at this earlier in the episode.
Right. Sorry, I neglected to answer that part of your question.
I shouldn't have asked you three questions in one, which is the main issue.
But it's a very important one. I get asked that quite a bit when I'm doing book events. And the reason I chose that title, the last president, obviously there's going to be other presidents who come along dealing with Europe. But in my view, first of all, he's the most pro-European French president in the post-war era. Nobody compares. De Gaulle, Chirac, Mitterrand. He really believes in the importance of creating a more integrated political community among the European states. And personally, he struck me as somebody who is the only person in leadership in Europe, and that included Angela Merkel when she was in power for 16 years, who espouses the values and standards and ideals of the founding fathers of post-war Europe, such as Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman, Winston Churchill, Paul-Henri Spaak, all of these great men who came together at the end of World War II when Europe was in ruins and said, we need to find a way to make war unthinkable in the future and to find a way to unite Europe. And Macron has made this, I mentioned earlier, he said, this is not just a, you know, pie in the sky dream that in order to create a United States of Europe, we need to be integrated. And in order to give ourselves the power and leverage to stand up against these other superpowers like the United States and China and Russia to defend Europe's own interests. And he was terribly frustrated, as I make clear in the book, that other leaders were afraid to join him in this bold project. And I describe the different perspectives, notably Merkel, who has always been an extremely cautious leader. They call her the Chancellor of Baby Steps. Takes one small step forward and looks all around, sees how the public is reacting. But it was particularly tragic, I think, that Macron came along at a time when Germany had a leader who was no longer a European-minded statesman, the way Helmut Kohl was, or Helmut Schmidt, or Willy Brandt, or even Konrad Adenauer, who were more European-minded than their French counterparts. And Merkel, it was particularly poignant because I once asked one of her closest aides, why won't she respond more positively to these appeals of Macron? And the answer was, she was never emotionally invested in Europe, because she grew up on the other side of the wall. And other leaders in Germany that I've talked to, like Wolfgang Schäuble, her finance minister, who was also chief of staff to Helmut Kohl, they grew up in Western Germany. And for them, the great achievement of the European Union was to make war unthinkable between France and Germany. And again, I urge to return to European history. For five centuries, every generation of German and French young people were either at war with each other or planning to go to war with each other. And in the aftermath of the European Union, that became, again, you know, beyond anyone's imagination. And let's hope that remains the case. But it was simply not shared, because Merkel's view, having grown up on the other side of the wall, was that this did not shape her historical consciousness.
And one other thing on Macron that I want to get to, because I think it's really important to play this out, because folks in the US probably haven't really thought about this in a while. I want you to speak to his political persona and the operational nature of his project, because this is what's fascinating about him. So he's a centrist, but he's one of the only centrists to run the style of campaign that a populist would run, in the sense that he hasn't held elected office before. He is very much pushing back against the status quo. You don't really see leaders operating, even younger leaders operating in that same sense. And then now that him too, he's young, but he's also kind of uptight. You know, there's the famous incident where very early in his leadership, a young person, I'm not going to butcher the French, but like refers to him in a sort of informal manner, and he just upbraids him in a way that you wouldn't expect. Yeah, he's 40 something,
which was kind of his nickname, would be the nickname for somebody called Emmanuel. And he said, no, you should address me as Monsieur le Président, which of course came off as very arrogant and, was badly received by the public. And I think that's part, that's one of his character flaws. He would admit that now, that his arrogance has hurt him, he's trying to soften his image a bit. I noticed that his latest political ads show him walking along in contemplation, alone, solitary, without any bodyguards or anything, along the River Seine. And some young people come up to him. One's a jogger, different backgrounds, and then they start making small talk, and he's much much more receptive to all of this. So I think
there was the I mean, I'm sure you saw this video, but when he was in Lebanon last year, he's, you know, going in shirt sleeves around and getting mobbed by the crowd. That seems very not 2017 Macron,
right? Yeah, no, I you know, again, he thinks you know, this is the subtitle of my book is Emmanuel Macron's race to revive France and save the world. And he genuinely grew up with this. He served as the researcher for a famous French philosopher named Paul Ricoeur, who believed that you needed to, if you were going to study politics, you needed to do everything you could to really reshape the world within your own power. And his other hero, Michel Rocard, a former prime minister who was a reformist, a socialist, also believed that, you know, in using ideas. I remember Rocard had this idea that we should, people are living longer, so we should break up the university phases in people's lives so that you, when you graduate at 21 or 22, you work one career, and then you go back to university at the age of 39 or 40 and learn a new career. So if you're bored with being a lawyer, you have the chance to study architecture or something, and then even do a third career. And he's proving to be right. A lot of people get tired. They don't want to work for one corporation for 40 years and then get a pension because the pensions don't exist anymore. And working for one company is not very very secure. So I think he's got a lot of the fresh ideas, and he wanted to apply those. And it'll be interesting. I think he will get a second 5-year term, but he really wants to shape a new order for the world. And I asked him, you know, I'm 30 years older than you. When you're my age, what do you think will have been the biggest transformation of the world? And, you know, he surprised me. He said, I think it will be the spectacular changes in Africa, because he says within 50 years, 1 in 3 human beings will be African, given the demographics, and he believes strongly that demographics shape history, and also climate change. He said there's going to be another tsunami of immigration coming up from Africa. He says, just look at Lake Chad. In 2030, 8 years from now, Lake Chad will be completely dried up. And there are 15 million people who live day to day off of the fish in the water in Lake Chad. And when it's dried up, those people are going to have to move, and they're going to have to move right away. They're not going to want to move to a neighboring country like Niger or Mali. They've all got cell phones, and they want to move to a more prosperous society. So he said, we have to be prepared for this. And he studied French historians, philosophers like Fernand Braudel, who talked about seeing the Mediterranean as a bridge between Europe and Africa, and that this could create a new golden age for Europe at the sort of a new cultural superpower working together with Africa, which would provide the population resources for this. And, you know, this is, again, it's not sort of crazy fantasies. Mm-hmm. He really does his homework and reads a lot about these things. And now he's going to have what I think is just as much of a challenge to rethink a European security order that establishes a peaceful regime with Ukraine, with Russia, and in the East.
You know, something I'm curious about I'm interested in whether the intellectual aspects of the leaders you're describing really matter. So in the sense that, you know, Boris Johnson, like him or don't like him, you know, he writes books. He's a columnist. Putin is writing these essays. I wouldn't call them accurate essays, but he's still writing essays. Macron is reading, you know, you talk in the book, he reads 90 minutes every morning. I would not describe the American political class separate from President Obama as intellectual. It's not an attack. I'm not saying anyone's stupid, but no one thinks Joe Biden is a person who reads books. The same thing is also not true of Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you, just as a reporter slash historian type, how do you evaluate the importance of that intellectual aspect given the specific set of challenges the world is facing right now?
Yeah, and I think this is one of the great tragedies of modern American politics, that we have become so homogenized in the way we run for office that there are so many do's and don'ts, and that you can't over-intellectualize things. People don't like to be talked down. But I think this is what has contributed to the polarization of our politics. And I think the only way that's going to change that is if we have in, let's say, the next few years, some leaders who will think like Macron and said, to hell with this, I'm going to just, you know, do it my way. I mean, this was one of the appeals, let's face it, of Donald Trump. You know, it's, you know, you can despise Trump. And I think that is the natural response to his grifter approach to politics. But nonetheless, he has taken on the system, and he shocked people and with his approach. And I think the American people are ready for somebody who thinks differently, but in a more positive sense, in the way that Macron has approached politics in France. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody who is reading high-minded books of political philosophy, but really starts talking sense and saying, you know, where are we taking this country? And, you know, just lay things out for people and come up with some fresh ideas that may be too controversial. For example, all right, nobody wants to talk about a draft, but why not advocate a year of national service for every person, you know, reaching the age of 18 or 19 or something like that? Well, right now, politically, that seemed to be something anathema to young, at a time when you're trying to attract young voters. But somebody who phrases that in the right way might appeal to a sense of citizenship and responsibility that would, in a way that would be beneficial, that would help alleviate the social and economic gaps by having people of all different backgrounds and ethnic bases to work together, and as we have seen when the military had a draft. So, you know, that's just one small idea, but I think it would be helpful.
You're not a political strategist here, so I don't expect the perfect answer here, but you kind of spoke to the contradiction in the Macronist project. And it provides a difficulty that American leaders who are following the model that you're describing, a model I agree with, are going to have to contend with, which is to do what he did, it actually takes a high degree of arrogance. Like you said, this weakness point. Arrogance is maybe the pejorative, but it takes a remarkable degree of self-assuredness in your vision. It takes the ability to say, look, I don't need to be elected to a lower office. I'm just going to run for the top job. How does one balance the need to be that style of person with the fact that when he operationalized this under his presidency, he had problems? So once again, the yellow vest, you know, is hit from nowhere because, as you put it, as he would admit, he's arrogant. So how does one balance the boldness and aggression with realism once one is actually in office?
Yeah, I think he would argue that a so-called lifetime experienced politician would probably have not succeeded any better than he did in trying to deal with, you know, these grassroots grievances of the yellow vests. And the irony was, of course, it grew out of a laudable policy initiative. He was trying to get the French people to shift from diesel vehicles, which are very highly polluting, in order to reduce their carbon emissions, either to electrical or less polluting, and even offering subsidies. But a lot of people said we can't afford a new car, so we're stuck with these. So, no, I think it's the argument that he was naive and inexperienced. Sure, that may have accounted for some mistakes, but I think we could use some of that somebody like that who wants to take risks and initiatives. And I don't know what kind of person that would be. It could be somebody with a business executive who has a proven record of leadership. Could be an athlete or a celebrity who attracts a strong following. But I think somebody needs to break the structure of our two political parties in such a way that... I'm not saying a third party candidate would be the solution, but certainly with the way Macron did it, he basically hijacked the Socialist Party, and he became the centrist because the socialists were moving too far left. The Gaullists were moving too far right, trying to capture voters who were going for Marine Le Pen, and he had the center to himself. And I think you can make an argument that's the case in the United States right now.
So here's the two quick last questions. So one, we started this episode by saying Putin's invasion could serve to paper over these structural issues and specific events that are fracturing Europe. Could you just go over quickly what those are? So what should folks have in the back of their mind as they are thinking about Europe? So migration, refugees, energy, what would you sum those up as?
Yeah, I think, to start with migration, I mean, the first book, Fractured Continent, grew out of the Great Migration Crisis and how that was shook up social welfare states in Scandinavia. It shook up Germany. But now that has settled down. Actually, Germany has succeeded admirably in integrating about 800,000 of these Syrian refugees, most of whom have jobs and are contributing to the society and have been quite successful in integrating there. Because the Germans had learned from their past mistakes, they immediately offered language lessons and found ways to bring them in. And we're still struggling, in having this useless political debate over what do we do about our southern border, our immigration debate. I think, as somebody who has followed Europe, European politics all my life, I think there's a lot we can learn from Europe. But, immigration, I don't know when we're ever going to reach a level of better clarity and understanding. For Europe, the energy issue is front and center right now. Germany clearly made a huge strategic blunder in casting its lot with Russia, Russia's oil and gas reserves. And I think Angela Merkel deserves a large share of the blame for that because she was in power for 16 years and allowed this to develop. But future issues are going to be what kind of society does Europe want to have? Because the welfare state has become so onerous that a lot of young people are seeking to leave because they want to go to the United States, somewhere where they can take advantage of their own initiative. Because As these societies get older, let's say Germany, for example, which is a rapidly aging society and has been for the last 20 years, it's so top heavy in terms of retirees who get all of these rather lavish benefits when you compare them to the United States, that the lower tier, the next generation, the youngest generation who are working, are going to be saddled with tax levels that could reach as high as 75% of their income. And they also say this is unsustainable. The ones I've talked to who want to leave for the United States or emigrate to Silicon Valley or elsewhere, they say not only would we have to pay this enormous burden from whatever salaries we're getting, we also know that it's not going to be available to us when we turn 60 or 65. So there has to be a reckoning here in terms of a fair and more just society that makes it easier for young people, because a lot of these countries, and not just the impoverished ones, but also the wealthier ones like France and Germany, are seeing a brain drain happening. They're going to Australia, they're going to Brazil, they're going to the United States because they feel they can maximize their potential best. And I think that's what Macron had in mind when he came into office. He asked me a lot about, I grew up in Silicon Valley, and it's remarkable that there is a reservoir about 80,000 young French people who have migrated to Silicon Valley. The French are very good in teaching mathematics, and so they have good educated talents for you know, the digital era. But he was saying we need to bring those people back to France, and the only way I can do that is to make France more and more attractive for young people. So that's also a project that he wants to work on in a second term.
So here's the final question. You referred to the United States as a European power, and that's definitely by dint of our troop presence in Europe, regardless of the philosophical issues there, no matter what. So just operationally, we are a power on the European continent that shapes a lot of decisions at a strategic and even domestic political level when it comes to the welfare states. But that statement about our European presence comes in the middle of this huge debate around whether or not the US is too balanced towards Europe, especially when it comes to competing with China. We had Elbridge Colby on earlier this week. He played a role in drafting the national defense strategy in 2018. Obviously, Trump isn't in office anymore, so I would not say that's Biden's approach. But when he was articulating his thoughts, he was like, look, we need to shift away from Europe. And this crisis has served to draw us back in at exactly the wrong moment when it comes to a rising China. So from your perspective, as you mentioned, like, you know, the need to compete with Beijing, how do we balance our ties to Europe, our ties to the West, the need to have the global order that Macron speaks with and speaks to me, and I think a lot of other people, with the fact that there is Asia and we are in a time of tough choices? What does the balance look like to you?
Well, I think the only way that the transatlantic partnership can survive and thrive in the 21st century is to have a better allocation of responsibilities for the next few decades. And by that, I mean, when Biden took office, it was clear it was all about China. And the way he structured his National Security Council, for example, 26 people were working in Kurt Campbell's shop, who was the czar for conceiving Indo-Pacific. The Europe section was stripped down. There were only two people working there under Amanda Sloat. So that showed that even though Biden had a background in pro-European, he was determined to be the president of more than Obama, certainly more than Trump, who carried out the pivot toward Asia. And it was going to leave Europe in the lurch. And Europeans I talked to as recently as last September were saying, well, we're very troubled by Biden's approach. He's taking a very tough stand on China and the threat of aggression on Taiwan. If China goes into Taiwan, there's going to be a call for maximum sanctions from the U.S. Congress and perhaps the administration, and that the Europeans should join us. And there was no strong feeling in Europe that we need to back the United States on this, because Germany in particular, which has a very mercantilist approach, you could say even economic nationalism, wanted to protect its trade relationship with China, and certainly didn't want to get embroiled in a security conflict there. And my view was that if the Europeans take that approach, there will be such a backlash in the United States among politicians, but also the public, saying for 75 years, we were the security guarantor of Europe. We were a European power, as I said. And to hell with this, if here we are facing an existential challenge to our leadership in the world, and the Europeans are running away from us. And I feared that that was going to be the next big challenge. Well, you know, shortly thereafter, we are now confronted with Russia and Ukraine. But coming out of this, it's really going to be up to Europe to take the initiative to devise a security order for Europe that allows the United States to focus on its challenges with China and elsewhere, and that Europe grows out of this phase of arrested development, like an adolescent who, you know, grows into a 40-year-old who still is dependent on his parents, this sort of thing. And that Europe has to, I'm hoping that this is the shock, a therapeutic shock that wakes up Europe and makes it more responsible for its own security. Because I share Macron's view as an American. I think it's healthy for America to have a strong and independent Europe that could take care of its own backyard. And together, the United States and Europe as the defenders of global democracy would be more effective in standing up to China and Russia and other autocrats.
Well, Bill, this has been incredibly helpful. Thank you for the background. Would love for you just to shout out your two most recent books, because even though Fractured Continent came out in 2017, I'm in the middle of it right now. I think it still really holds up and is a good way of centering one's thinking. So please just shout your books out.
Well, I've written the two books, Fractured Continent, which was called one of the best political books in 2017 by the Financial Times. And then The Last President of Europe, Emmanuel Macron's Race to Revive France and Save the World. And I'm working on a new project, which unfortunately the narrative has exploded because of the Russia-Ukraine project. But I'm continuing to follow the modern history, modern popular history of Europe. And that's what I'm going to concentrate on in the years to come.
You're going to have to add a couple chapters now. Bill, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Okay, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.